With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. California Farm Bureau delegation makes its voice heard in Washington, D.C. Leaders of the California Farm Bureau are calling attention to important agricultural issues such as the next federal farm bill, labor, water, forestry, and the response to disasters, including flooding and wildfires. During the most recent advocacy trip on May 23rd through the 25th, the Board of Directors and Federal Policy Team for California's largest agricultural organization met with lawmakers, including House Agricultural Committee Chairman Representative Glenn G.T. Thompson. Farm Bureau President Jamie Johansson testified before a House subcommittee on reducing wildfire dangers to protect California agriculture. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report, and now let's get into today's show headlines. Three agricultural employment policy bills advance. The Senate recently passed three ag employment policy bills. Agricultural stakeholders, including Farm Bureau, are opposed to these bills. Senate Bill 553 by Senator Dave Cortez imposes the expansion and detailed requirements of Cal OSHA's healthcare workplace violence regulation on all California employers, regardless of industry or size. Those opposed say SB 553 disrupts ongoing Cal OSHA regulatory process in which the agency is seeking to craft a workplace violence regulation more suited to a general industry. SB 399, authored by Senator Ayesha Wahab, prohibits employers from conducting employee meetings in the context of a unionization campaign to explain the employer's opposition to unionization. Farm Bureau says this bill, quote, is a clear-cut violation of an employer's First Amendment right to free speech and will curb employers' rights to fully inform employees about unionization activities. And lastly, Senate Bill 616 by Senator Lena Gonzalez to increase the paid sick leave mandate first established by Senator Gonzalez in 2013 from 3 days or 24 hours to 7 days and 56 hours. No provision is made in Senate Bill 616 to allow employers to manage misuse of paid sick leave. And now here's Brian German with more agriculture news.
Herbicide resistance concerned with common chickweed is prompting further study as to the appropriate next steps for addressing the issue. Cooperative Extension Farm Advisor Nick Clark said the work to determine impacts of resistance on yield will ultimately determine what course of action growers will be advised to take.
In the instance where we find that the weeds are causing reductions in yield, well, we've yet to see that, so I think it would warrant more investigation on our part to try and really hone some weed management tools to make sure that we're protecting yield out there. So it becomes a different story. It's not just one about doing pesticide resistance management, but also one of protecting yield. So it's hard to say what our recommendations would be now when we haven't actually found that to be true.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network. The UC Davis Departments of Plant Pathology and Plant Sciences, along with the California Tomato Research Institute, is hosting a Harvester Sanitation Field Day in Dixon in a few weeks. Harvester sanitation has become a critical area of focus in tomato production as a cornerstone to efforts to prevent further spread of broom rape. The field day will take place on Thursday, June 22nd in Dixon, with check-in beginning at 8 in the morning. Topics will include an overview of ongoing research on broom rape management in processing tomatoes, addressing critical sanitation control points on tomato harvest equipment, and sanitizers tested for efficacy against broom rape seed directly. David Vigay of Timothy and Vigay Farming will also be sharing their year-round equipment sanitation practices, opening up a group discussion on sanitation BMPs. More information about the field day is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, Chief Agricultural Negotiator Doug McCaleb says the importance of specialty crops isn't lost on the U.S. Trade Representative's office.
It is a major area of emphasis for USTR and for the White House to ensure that trade is reaching everybody and to make sure that every commodity is benefiting from the promise of trade.
McCaleb was a featured speaker at the AgriPulse Food and Ag Summit West held in Sacramento, California. He said the office doesn't only focus on big crops like grains.
We have a rallying cry in our office, and that is that there is no marketplace around the globe that is too small to spend time trying to open up that marketplace to U.S. farmers, and there is no commodity too small by volume for us not to spend time and effort trying to open up marketplaces around the globe for those commodities as well. And that goes for organics, it goes for biofuels, which I think is another area that requires a lot of attention, and it goes for all kinds of specialty crops, fruit and vegetables, etc.
During his comments, McCaleb touched on Mexico's refusal of biotech corn and the USTR's formal dispute over the matter.
Just last week, USTR announced that it would begin formal dispute processes under the USMCA with Mexico over biotech. Based upon Mexico's policy on biotech, they have not been following sound regulatory processes. They have not been following science. And as a result, it's important for the U.S. to stand up for the correct scientific processes that were signed onto as part of USMCA. So this will begin effort under Chapter 31 of USMCA to work on dispute settlement with Mexico. This is an issue of vital importance, not just to corn growers in the U.S., but for everyone, because, quite frankly, if trading partners are not following risk assessments in their regulatory work, that causes a major issue for all of agriculture, each and every commodity that's out there.
And he talked about the issue of dairy trade with Canada.
Similarly, with respect to our neighbors to the north, we have recently launched a second case on Canada's dairy approach. The U.S. won its first case in November of 2021. But in response to that case, Canada has still not provided meaningful market access to dairy farmers from the United States. So our second case will focus in specifically on their existing shortcomings and where Canada has failed to provide meaningful retail and full market access to Canada. So these are examples, again, while we are on one hand working around the globe, opening up new places to new commodities, we also have to work hard to make sure that countries are, again, not doing a new favor for us, but that they are living up to what they signed when they signed on the dotted line on existing trade agreements.
He also explained how his office works for U.S. ag trade.
American farmers produce some of the most high-quality, best-recognized, reliable, and incredibly consistent products anywhere in the globe. And I feel that in many ways, U.S. farm products sell themselves and their reputation precedes themselves around the world. But part of my role is to ensure that in cases where there is a willing buyer around the globe who is interested in wants those high-quality products, that there isn't a government somewhere around the globe that stands in between that farmer and a willing marketplace and a willing buyer. So that is really the focus for my office within the U.S. Trade Representative. Our agriculture office team works tirelessly on behalf of U.S. farmers, ranchers, foresters to ensure that they can connect around the globe in those international marketplaces.
That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, the U.S. Drought Monitor is showing a total drought coverage in the contiguous 48 states at its lowest point since 2020. And due to steady precipitation this year in the West and now the Midwest, we're seeing improving pasture and rangeland conditions nationwide.
We are actually, as you look at the national numbers, seeing our highest U.S. rangeland and pasture conditions at this point at any time of year since back in 2020, almost exactly 3 years ago, the actual week where we saw a higher national rangeland and pasture condition was June 7th of 2020.
That's USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey. He looks at the states with significant good to excellent pasture and rangeland condition ratings.
Broad areas of the country in the west, the north, and the east reporting rangeland and pastures on the statewide level greater than 70%. California leads the west, 90% good to excellent. As for the Midwest, Wisconsin leads 76% good to excellent.
Of course, there are areas still experiencing issues with very short to short pasture and rangeland conditions. That's mostly in the Midwest and eastern parts of the country. But Rippey also notes the U.S. Drought Monitor drought coverage maps for both major hay growing and cattle producing states.
Just 20% of the U.S. hay production area considered to be in drought at the end of May, and 36% of the U.S. cattle inventory in drought. Those numbers may sound a little high, but they're a far cry from what we've been experiencing the last 3 years since this long-term drought settled in back in summer of 2020. We finally clawed our way out of that, and much better situation now for the central and western U.S. heading into 2023.
Again, that's USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey. Well, the National Milk Producers Federation is applauding the U.S. Department of Agriculture for proposing an action plan for a national hearing based on NMPA's proposal to modernize federal milk marketing orders, or FMMOs. NMPF is looking forward to the next phase of creating a federal order system that better reflects today's market conditions and dairy producer needs. NMPS FMMO proposal offers comprehensive solutions that recognize the needs of today's dynamic industry. NMPF President and CEO Jim Mulhern said, "We're grateful USDA recognizes the comprehensive nature of our proposal and are looking forward to it being considered in full, because the whole of our plan adds up to more than the sum of its parts." And NMPF President and CEO Jim Mulhern announced Tuesday that he will retire at the end of this year. Mulhern will conclude a decade of service leading the organization and capping at 45 years in U.S. agricultural and dairy policy. But then on Wednesday, during the NMPF Board of Directors meeting in Arlington, Virginia, a new top executive was announced. The board unanimously voted to name Greg Dowd, a globally recognized ag leader, as its next president and CEO. Dowd has served in numerous leadership roles in trade association and government work in his more than 30-year career in agricultural policy and economics. From 2018 to 2021, he served as chief ag negotiator for the U.S. Learn more about this on the NMPF website, nmpf.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows, or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
What GMO crops are grown and sold in the U.S.? Well, there's corn, like me, soybeans, canola, sugar beets, and cotton. Typically, we're ingredients in certain foods. GMO alfalfa, corn, soybeans, canola, and cotton are used as animal food. And while you won't find many GMOs in the produce section, there are versions of GMO apple, summer squash, potato, and papaya in a few markets. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
How peanuts pack a punch in the fight against Alzheimer's. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. Alzheimer's disease affects more than 6 million Americans. There's now growing evidence that peanuts can help address the disease by supporting brain health. The Peanut Institute says, first, peanuts have high levels of niacin and are a good source of vitamin E, two nutrients that have long been known to protect against Alzheimer's disease and other age-related cognitive decline. Second, peanuts contain a bioactive that is believed to be beneficial in fighting against Alzheimer's and other nerve-degenerating diseases. Third, peanuts pack P-cumeric acid, which studies have found helps reduce stress and anxiety. Finally, peanuts have a unique combination of healthy fats, vitamins, minerals, fiber, and protein that deliver both mind and body benefits. A new study published this month shows older adults who consumed peanuts or treenuts at least 3 times per week had more favorable changes in cognitive performance than those who didn't. I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCullough. In a recent tax court case, the IRS claimed that a part-time farmer wasn't really a farmer because he used old tractors. But the tax court said the method he chose for farming didn't preclude him from being a farmer for tax purposes. The IRS audited a part-time farmer and claimed that he really wasn't a farmer because he used numerous old tractors that were mostly 40 to 50 years old. He worked full-time as a UPS driver and farmed both before and after his shifts. Over the years, he acquired 5 non-contiguous farms totaling about 500 acres. The farms were several miles apart, and he kept certain tractors at each of his farms with implements attached to save him time and effort. He also personally did the maintenance on the tractors. During the audit years, he bought 29 tractors and fully depreciated them in their year of purchase. The IRS claimed that his tractors were for personal purposes because he was an antique collector, and denied the depreciation and other costs related to them. But the tax court disagreed, noting that his chosen method of farming over a long period of time allowed him to avoid debt and do his own maintenance. While the court disallowed some depreciation due to errors, the case points out that you are allowed discretion in how you want to farm. But make sure you maintain good records and don't commingle your personal and business expenses. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCullough.
Mulhern to retire as NMPF President and CEO. National Milk Producers Federation President and CEO Jim Mulhern announced on Tuesday that he will retire at the end of this year. Mulhern will conclude a decade of service leading the organization and capping a 45-year career in U.S. agriculture and dairy policy. Mulhern says, quote, "Directing the policy efforts of the nation's dairy farmers and their cooperatives has been the highlight of my professional career." Mulhern began as president and CEO in 2013 and guided NMPF through 2 complete farm bills, the COVID-19 crisis, and an ever-quickening pace of change in the industry. After coming to Washington to work on Capitol Hill in 1982, he began his first stint with NMPF in 1985, directing the organization's government affairs activities and shaping NMPF's strategy in the face of earlier farm crises. The topic of naming a new top executive at NMPF will be discussed at the NMPF's board meeting later this week in Arlington, Virginia. NAFB contributed to that report. For Agnet West, I'm Danielle Leal.
Back in the 1950s and 60s, this Frank Sinatra song went like this.
They got an awful lot of coffee in Brazil.
And by the 1980s, that would also apply to soybeans, big time. But this year, you could change that to they've got an awful lot of corn.
A record second crop corn out of Brazil.
Agriculture Department Chief Economist Seth Meyer wouldn't sing it for us, but he would say it, and he says it will probably be a 130 million ton crop, or about 5 billion bushels. The U.S. crop this season is projected at about 15 billion, so that Brazilian crop, substantial.
And so that's putting some downward price pressure. Obviously, it's really affecting competition in the market now.
Brazil, traditionally, of course, has been pretty much a minor player in the world corn market, but now...
they are a big player. They have a big crop, and they've seen their own price or basis really fall sharply as that big crop comes online.
Which brings us to the question, what happens next for Brazil's corn production and marketing system?
It will be interesting over the coming years to see how that market has to develop, because the Brazilians aren't going to be able to dump such large crops on the market without really hammering price in the future.
Meyer says, remember what happened years ago as Brazil's soybean production grew and grew and grew.
As the South Americans got bigger, we would get 6 months of carry until the next crop came on from South America, and then maybe you see reduced carry because there's another production opportunity.
And so that begs the question,
will we see the same thing develop for corn now that the Brazilian crop is getting bigger?
Certainly, even this year, Meyer says, because of the huge Brazilian corn crop coming on, we are seeing already
the downward adjustment in our own export volumes and prices for corn.
A few days ago, USDA chopped $2 billion off its 2023 forecast for U.S. corn exports. They could end up down 25% from last year, all because they've got an awful lot of corn in Brazil. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
And now, another episode of One Soil to Live.
All right, let's take a look, Claude. I see you've been keeping it covered.
Yes, I have.
And it appears you haven't disturbed it.
Well, I've tried really hard not to.
You're using living roots throughout the year with diverse species and rotations, right?
Just exactly as you prescribed, Doctor.
Well, I'll have to say I'm impressed with your organic matter, aggregation, and microbial activity. Claude, I'm happy to report that your soil is fit as a fiddle.
Oh, thank you. I guess it's true that soil health management systems are just what the doctor ordered.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
Improving soil health can make your farm more productive, profitable, and resilient. Visit your local USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service office today and learn more about the basics and benefits of soil health. This message brought to you by USDA and this radio station.
Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
The S&P 500 could be giving signals of a return to a bull market on Wall Street. And a bull market, certainly a proper term for cattle futures at the CME Group. I'm Mark Oppold with your bottom line report for this Thursday, brought to you by Superior Livestock. Keep an eye on that S&P 500 today and tomorrow. Wall Street analysts say a close over 4,300 would put the market in a bull territory that would end the longest-running bear market since the 1940s. In a related event, nearly 80% of investors now think the Federal Reserve will not raise interest rates at their meeting next week. And the popular VIX index, often called the fear index, dropped to its lowest level since February 2020 this week, also a positive sign. Speaking of that bull market, proper name for cattle futures, setting all-time high seeming almost every day. Superior Livestock Corn Belt Classic had their first day of sales yesterday, $10 to $15 higher for feeder steers and heifers, some close to $20 higher later in the day. We still see futures retreating, though, into tomorrow's close. We do have day two of the Corn Belt Classic today. This is the Bottom Line Report. Volatility, the name of the game in the grain trade. Traders hanging on every forecast. Demand factors, though they are weak, take a back seat for now. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day.
Finding new money for specialty crops in the Farm Bill. Dave Puglia, president and CEO of Western Growers and co-chair of the Specialty Crop Farm Bill Alliance, says it's hard to say what is the most important of all priorities for specialty crops in the Farm Bill. But he says there is at least one important goal.
Going into any farm bill cycle where the specialty crop industry still has a toehold and doesn't necessarily have the strongest toehold politically, the first order of business is no going backwards.
Puglia said his second important goal was to find new money for new research and programs that would directly benefit specialty crops. Still, he said that's going to take some work, as he learned at a meeting with Michigan Senator and Chair of the Senate Ag Committee, Debbie Stabenow.
And she immediately looked at myself and a couple of my colleagues who were with me from the Alliance and said, there won't be any new money, so don't ask.
You can read more on this story on our website, agnetwest.com. I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And in more agriculture news, John Deere will continue to serve as the title sponsor of a PGA Tour event near its corporate headquarters in Malin, Illinois. The three-year extension was announced earlier this week. John Deere Classic Tournament Director Andrew Lehman says the relationship started back in 1998.
It is huge, and I think it's a testament to their support of this event for over 25 years in this community. John Deere is such a mainstay. You know, from a company standpoint, and their missions and goals really align with ours from a, you know, civic standpoint and philanthropic standpoint. So to have them be able to put their name on it for the next 3 years and know that this community is going to benefit from that is so important in all of our charities.
This year's tournament is held next month, July 6th through the 9th, at the TPC at Deer Run in Silvis, Illinois. The prize purse includes $7.4 million.
Well, maybe it's time to drag out this fake commercial that radio comedy pioneer Stan Freberg did back in the 1950s, a commercial simply advertising food, yes, as the number one cure for hunger.
Any time is the time for food, 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 food. Just put it in your mouth, chew it up with your teeth, and swallow it. You can bet your bottom dollar you'll say, food is good.
Yeah, it's good, all right. And the news about food prices is pretty good. Now, yes, food prices in general are continuing to increase, but at a slower monthly rate than many experts had been expecting. And that
has also decreased our expectations for what food price inflation looks like for 2023.
Back at the end of April, Agriculture Department economist Matt McLaughlin was projecting the grocery store food prices this year would top last year by 6.6%. Now
we have an expected percent increase of 6.3%.
That's a sign of what Matt calls disinflation, not price deflation, but gradual slowing of inflation. He says food price increases are being slowed down by monthly price declines for several food categories, eggs being one of them. Matt says there have been no new cases of bird flu in commercial egg-laying flocks since late last year.
So egg prices are continuing to decrease. They decreased by another 1.5% last month.
They are still, though, over 20% higher than a year ago, but coming down.
We have other categories like pork, which has continued to decrease. We're now at 2.2% below where we were last year.
And beef is averaging 0.5% below what it was selling for last year. Now, one of the food categories that has seen huge price spikes over the last year, fats and oils. Things like butter and salad dressings and such, the price of fats and oils has declined slightly over the last month or so.
However, it's still 13.8% above where it was this time last year. So we still are on a general pattern of growth, but it's slowing, particularly relative to 2022, when it grew by 18.5% during the year.
Another category of food with a very big price hike last year, cereal and bakery products. Those prices went up 13% last year. Matt's expecting another increase this year, but a smaller one, just under 10%. So again, for grocery store food prices for all products this year, Matt McLaughlin is expecting prices to go up an average of 6.3%. But we are only halfway through 2023, so 6.3 is the middle of a range of possible outcomes. He says price hikes could range from
between 4.5% increases and 8.1% increases.
But even at 8%, it would still be a smaller price increase than the almost 11.5% hike we saw last year. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
Today's specialty crop news brought to you by the Almond Board of California. You can find them online at almonds.com. We had the opportunity to speak with Director for Sustainability and Environmental Affairs for the Almond Board, Gabrielle Ludwig, about a recent event highlighting MRLs and how they impact export opportunities.
So the MRL workshop has been around for more than 10 years. I'm trying to remember how long it's been around. It got started to just try and bring people together to talk about how do we improve harmonization of maximum residue limits around the globe. The California Specialty Crop Council is the manager or the host of it. And this year it was held in San Diego. for the almond industry, we've been active participants since the go because we're highly exported crops. So MRLs and their harmonization is a key issue for us to be able to export into our key markets. The workshop really does a couple of things. One is it's one of the few places that brings together growers, grower groups, registrants, and government officials, U.S. and also sometimes from other places in the world. So it's a unique place to have some conversations across worlds about how do we get to, what are the issues and are there any paths forwards for improving the harmonization efforts around the world. It's also for growers who come as individuals a place to just learn about what is an MRL, how is it set, what are the issues going on that might affect me as a grower and my pest management decisions. This year, I would say the conference really focused a bit more on what's going on in the international space, plus an update from various U.S. government officials. There's always some technical things. But I mean, the big issues that I saw for California growers, those that export to the EU, almonds, roughly 25% or so of the crop does go to the EU. The EU has set itself very strong goals for what they call the Green Deal, including wanting to get 50% reduction of pesticide use within Europe by 2030. They have not finalized legislation yet, so who knows if that will really happen, but that's the goal. And what EU has decided is basically if their growers can't use it, then they need to reset the MRLs to what's called a default tolerance so that it makes it harder for that importers are put on essentially the same playing field sort of más o menos. So we have already seen the EU lowering MRLs. And the question is really, how is that going to move forward? What's going on? And the big issue right now in Europe is that they're not just focusing on, are there human health concerns? And that would be driving the cancellation of registration in Europe and then the lowering of the MRLs. They're now also lowering MRLs for environmental reasons. And that is completely new policy. MRL is a cover grower rear end number that's looked at as a health, you know, making sure that if you add that residue with all the other residues that you're exposed to, you don't exceed any health issues. And the EU is basically saying, even if we don't have health issues, if we have some kind of global environmental impact of concern, in this case pollinators, then we also are going to use the MRLs to reset and have limited ability to use it elsewhere in the world, which is a really big change. And not convinced that it's legal within the WTO and all the international trade agreements, but the EU is trying to figure out how to make that happen. So that was, I'd say, took up a chunk of the conversation at the conference. The other place that has become worrisome, and this is new, is Mexico. Mexico traditionally has just used the MRLs from the United States or other key markets, and that is still the case, but the Mexican government has decided that they want to protect their own growers and get rid of the use of glyphosate, so they're no longer allowing the import of glyphosate, and they are trying to limit imports of certain GMO crops. And that whole philosophy of the chemical pesticide use needs to be reduced, that is permeating more and more parts of the Mexican government. So we don't know how much longer they will defer to U.S. tolerances, or whether at some point in time they're going to say you have to follow our own tolerances, whatever that is. But it's just interesting to me that, you know, a longtime partner that we've always relied on could become a problem for MRLs in the near future. The other things were updates from the U.S. government in terms of what they were doing. So we heard from Office of Pesticide Programs, from the Codex Office, from the Foreign Agriculture Service. So getting a sense of what they're working on, how they're trying to manage these MRL issues in the various markets. And so those are some of the key things that were raised. From my perspective, I mean, there are always some things about how easy or hard is it to do testing. Wiley, now who's recently moved to USDA ARS, you know, he talked about, oh, you know, if you really wanted to test for everything, you're looking at over $1,000, $1,500 because you need all these different tests for different chemistry classes. So how do you parse that? So there's some things like that at this conference as well. But at the end of the day, it's not only the content, but it's also a chance for those sidebar conversations. You know, what about this? What about that? Those kinds of conversations are always good at a conference.
And now just as this relates to the Almond Board and how you're translating some of this information to growers, I mean, growers obviously need to be pay attention to this because this might limit where some of their products can go. So how can growers kind of stay up to date, or what are some of the information they need to consider or kind of consult in terms of knowing where their almonds are going and what some of those protocols are going to be to make sure that they continue to have access to some of those markets?
Well, that's something actually we've been working on internally at the Almond Board. Actually, our board of directors last year asked staff to do something called a pesticide strategy. And a lot of that was driven by how do we help the industry have a better sense of what's happening on MRLs and how that might affect the pest management choices of growers. Because there's a time lag between when you do a treatment and when those nuts actually get exported. Because you may do a treatment in May, and that export may not happen until a year or year and a half later, and which time things could have changed from a regulatory perspective. So what we're really realizing is, one is we on our own, with the help of consultants, are just trying to keep up to speed on the changes, especially with the EU. And we're providing information on a regular basis to handlers. Because for growers, it's impossible to grow to a specific market. Most almond growers have no idea where their nuts are going to end up. We have over 7,000 growers and about 100 handlers. I mean, it's good to talk to your handler and find out what are their key markets, because that can help. But really what I'm expecting to happen is handlers are going to start looking at this and where we have residue. So the Almond Board also does residue testing, which really helps us, because many times a change doesn't make any difference because we're already meeting it or we don't have any residues. But really we're looking at, you know, where do we have what I call problem children, letting handlers know. And then the handlers can choose to communicate that to their growers, yes or no, depending on what markets they're exporting to or what the issues are that they're facing. So that's kind of how we're trying to handle it, because almond growers, most of them have no idea where their nuts are going to end up, some 90 different countries, and nuts are not segregated by orchard. They're sorted by size and quality. So really we're trying to figure out how do we help that communication stream. If you just in the short term, that doesn't necessarily tell you the future, but for right now, growers can always go to the MRL or PCAs, go to the MRL database, which is a global MRL database, which for the United States you can use for free, and you can get a current MRLs. What it doesn't tell you is if there's something that we can already see on the horizon that might impact you. But it's good first to check, are there any lower MRLs or substantially lower MRLs where you might have issues?
So best bet is for growers to just kind of be in pretty close contact with their handlers, just to know and stay up to date on, okay, what are you going to expect from us to make sure that you get what you need to get out to where it needs to go?
Correct. I think this is an area where for the first time we will see more and more handlers telling growers things to do or not to do, which has traditionally not been the way almonds are grown. Growers have had the freedom to grow as they saw fit, and then handlers had to figure out how to deal with whatever the choices were the grower made. But in this arena, I'm expecting that in the future, especially if EU is a large part of a handler's portfolio, that we may get more of, please don't use XYZ compounds so we don't get residues that could cause us issues in the EU. Now, mind you, it's not just on the grower side. There are also residues coming from the post-harvest, facility, what I call the facility use compounds. So the handlers themselves and the hauler shellers need to take a look at their pesticide use as well.
Thanks, Brian. And stay tuned as we'll have more of the day's agriculture news and farm features here on the AgNet News Hour. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search our name of AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet West. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
This is Zach Ducheneau, Administrator for USDA's Farm Service Agency, reminding farmers and ranchers that the deadline to report most crops is July 17th. It's important to report your acreage by the applicable deadline after planning is complete in order to meet program eligibility requirements for many USDA programs. Acreage reporting deadlines vary by crop and by county, and to report your acres, you can call your local FSA office to make an appointment. To find the local office information, visit farmers.gov.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. California's Crop Progress and Conditions Report. For the week ending June 4th, California continued to experience mildly warm temperatures as summer officially began. 95% of the state is still considered without drought or in a region coming out of drought, and all major reservoirs are at 78% of capacity or higher, with the exception of Trinity Lake at 53% of capacity. In the northern mountains, the first cutting of alfalfa was baled. Farmers in Sutter County wrapped up seeding of rice fields. Sacramento Valley winter wheat crops were drying down with warmer daytime temperatures. The rice crop was emerging slowly due to the cooler temperatures, and herbicide applications were made. In Stanislaus County, corn was emerging. Alfalfa was harvested for silage and dried for hay. Silage corn, rice, Sudan grass were sprayed for weeds, and harvest finished up for wheat and oat silage. In the San Joaquin Valley, snow melt continued to impact low-lying cotton fields. Flood warnings remained active. And down in Tulare County, winter grain fields that were harvested were now fertilized, tilled, and planted with summer silage crops such as corn and sorghum. Cotton and corn silage fields showed rapid growth and were treated for weeds, and alfalfa fields continued to be cut, raked, and baled. Grape farmers sprayed for weeds and thinned vineyards. Some stone fruit continued to develop, while apricots, cherries, and early peach varieties were picked. All citrus varieties in season continued to be picked and packed. Mandarins and tangerines remained netted. Dates continued to ripen, and kiwi vineyards were leafing out, being tied and irrigated. Bees were also active in kiwi vineyards, as well as melon fields. Almond growers reported navel orange worm in many orchards across the state. Growers also began prepping for ants by placing bait traps. More walnut orchards were removed, and some pistachio growers started small plant bug treatments. Up in the Sacramento Valley, farmers wrapped up asparagus harvest, while cherry tomatoes continued to progress. In Tulare County, sweet corn, eggplant, okra, onions, broccoli, cabbage, peppers, and garlic continued to grow. Up in Stanislaus County, onions were harvested, watermelon, honeydew, and cantaloupe were planted and weeded. The transplanting of sweet potatoes and tomatoes continued. Greenhouse tomatoes were harvested. Bell peppers, carrots, eggplants were all harvested as well in the Imperial Valley. And in the Salinas Valley, broccoli, cauliflower, and celery were harvested, with quality to be above average.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.